Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. U.S. President Trump and North Korean Chairman Kim Jong-un have completed their second denuclearization summit. Co-host of Loud and Clear, Brian Becker, is in Hanoi. Brian, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thanks, Wilmer. Glad to be here.
Before we get into the specifics and the details, your overall sense of what's been transpiring these last few days in Hanoi?
Well, I mean, this was a follow-up to the June 12th, 2018 Singapore summit where Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un came together in what was very historic, literally, because it was the first time the heads of state for the United States and the North Korean government had met together directly. They had a Singapore declaration with 4 points, pledging to improve relations between the two countries, establishing a mechanism for peace on the Korean Peninsula, moving towards denuclearization, and fourth, the return of missing in action remains of American soldiers who died during the Korean War. This summit, there was a lot of expectations. You know, a couple of weeks ago, there was a lot of talk about the Trump administration was tamping down expectations. Well, the fact of the matter is there was high expectations that this was going to lead to something very also historic, and that would be a declaration by the two leaders that the Korean War was finally coming to an end 68 years and 6 months after it began. That did not happen. To the shock of people who were present at the very last moment, I'm literally talking in the last hour before the signing ceremony, between a lunch and a signing ceremony and a scheduled press conference here in Hanoi, where Donald Trump was supposed to address the assembled media before he boarded Air Force One. The rumor came, the word came that things were changing. And then it turned out that the lunch between Trump and Kim Jong-un did not happen. More importantly, the signing ceremony was canceled. And then there was a press conference where Trump himself and only Trump, meaning or Trump and Pompeo, no North Korean, addressed the media. In other words, the characterization that the talks have collapsed, I think we can live with that as an apt characterization, given the level of expectations. This agreement did not happen. There was no declaration that the Korean War was ended. Donald Trump, when he spoke to the media, said, when he's trying to sort of affix blame for what happened, he said it was about the sanctions, meaning that the DPRK wanted significant or comprehensive sanctions relief in exchange for the dismantling of the Yongbyon nuclear facility, their main nuclear facility. The American government was unwilling to do that and insisted that there had to be complete 100% denuclearization or something along those lines. By the way, just to be careful that we're not wrong on this, Donald Trump himself was a little bit more cautious when he spoke to the press about the language of complete 100% comprehensive denuclearization. In fact, he went out of his way, I think, to sort of leave a little room there. But the bottom line is the U.S. was offering sanctions relief only after more than the shutting down of the Yongbyon nuclear facility. North Korea, according to Trump, was not prepared to do that.
You were in Singapore for the first summit. So
I was, yeah.
Can you compare the vibe, the relationship between the two leaders from the first summit to this summit?
The vibe was comparable. I mean, there was a lot of expectation. I would say enthusiasm. It's all over the place. It's among the press corps, not the White House press corps, because they're a jaded group. But, you know, the other journalists, I think they had high expectation. Most of them are from Asia. That was true in Singapore, too. A lot of enthusiasm, a lot of sense that we were, you know, watching history unfold in front of us. And that makes, I think, the disappointment here coming as it did at the last moment in an unexpected way, pretty jarring for people. And, you know, if you turn on the TV here in Hanoi and watch Asian-based channels, this is the news. What happened? What does it mean? Does it mean that the process is coming to an end? If so, the prospect of peace being replaced with the possibility of even a larger confrontation, all those kind of questions come to the fore. Donald Trump got on Air Force One. He had apparently a long discussion with South Korean President Moon Jae-in. Moon Jae-in is scheduled to speak and will speak on tomorrow, March 1st, which is the centennial of the beginning of the Korean independence movement from Japanese colonialism. There was an expectation that Moon Jae-in would be able to herald this great new day of peace between North Korea and the United States, and thus peace between the two Koreas, and to offer a number of economic incentives for a North-South economic collaboration that would help stimulate the North Korean economy. That all has to be, you know, held in abeyance to some degree. But what we're hearing is that President Trump, when he talked to Moon Jae-in, asked him to directly mediate to keep this process going. So, you know, Trump has invested a lot. He's invested a lot of political capital. If he fails at this, his critics and their Democrats, the Republicans, they're the military industrial complex, they're the intelligence agencies, they're the most of the mainstream media, corporate owned media. Those are his opponents. They will take glee in his failure. They don't actually care that much about what happens to people on the Korean Peninsula. I do. I think people of conscience should. But I think the media critics of Trump couldn't care less about them. If he fails on Korean peace talks, they'll think, good, Donald Trump has failed. And as a consequence, Donald Trump has to do something to not fail. And that something right now appears to be the best hope for it seems to be to help or hope or that Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, intercedes forcefully with the North Koreans, who he has a good relationship with, to keep this thing going.
Were you able to get any sense that President Moon Jae-in was behind the scenes during this summit, or was he kind of on the sidelines and now Trump is asking him to take a larger role?
Well, it's both things. It's interesting that you posed the question that way. Moon Jae-in was on the sidelines in the sense that he's not a direct participant here. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is between the U.S. and North Korea. But Moon Jae-in, in many ways, was the catalyst for the entire process. He's a popular president. He came to office and replaced Park Yeon-hee. She was the daughter of a South Korean dictator, military dictator. She had been completely opposed to any rapprochement with North Korea. He, on the other hand, was favoring it. He's cultivated.
He even ran on it. Wasn't that one of the major platforms of his campaign, was that he was going to play a major role in reuniting the countries?
Yeah, I mean, he certainly signaled that he wanted to look for an accommodation. I think he had other parts to his program, mainly cleaning up the vast corruption from the prior administration in South Korea. But yes, you're right. He had a peace plank. He wanted to bring and accelerate the peace process on the Korean Peninsula. So Moon Jae-in is perfectly situated to be the person to keep things going right now. Let's remember, I want to emphasize where I started, Donald Trump, who I oppose on almost all things, but not on this thing. Donald Trump has enormous headwinds in Washington. And so unless there's some way to keep this process going, any inertia right now, any failure to keep momentum going forward, I think all the crevices, the space, the cracks will be filled up by the naysayers who don't want this to happen.
We had been reading here since Monday about a signing ceremony. So that indicated to me that going into the summit, the signing ceremony had basically been negotiated. I mean, if you're going to talk about a Thursday signing ceremony and you're going to talk about it on Monday, then the parties, to me, going in must have had some idea that there would be something to sign. So do you have any insight into, was it as simple as the sanctions issue?
Well, I think what happened is this. They did have a signing plan. There was a paper. There was a document. Trump even alluded to the fact that he was with those signing documents even shortly prior to the decision not to have the signing ceremony.
Yeah, that's the basis of my question. So, yeah, thank you. Go ahead.
So then what happened? I think probably what happened is this, that Donald Trump thought he had an agreement. They came into the meeting. They got the word from Kim Jong-un that the North Koreans were prepared to shut down their primary nuclear facility. that's the Yongbyon facility, and in exchange that there would be the beginning or partial lifting of sanctions. That would be the step-by-step reciprocal approach. At the meeting, and I can't believe the North Koreans knew this ahead of time. I don't think they did. And we can talk about why they might not have. The U.S. side presented to the North Koreans that they had information that there were other nuclear facilities beyond Yongbyon. Maybe they were smaller facilities, but they existed. And that North Korea had to, one, close all of the facilities as a precursor, as a precondition for the lifting of sanctions, not just Yongbyon, which is what the North Koreans were prepared to do. And possibly Mike Pompeo also raised the issue of existing warheads and missiles. He alluded to that in the press conference. Now, ballistic missile technology is separate from nuclear bombs. Mm-hmm. They're a delivery system. They're different. And if what the North Koreans were hearing was, hey, it's not just about Yongbyon facility, but you have to do everything, and you have to do it all at once as a precondition before we will lift the sanctions, then you could see why, if they weren't prepared to do that, it would be the sort of the demand put on Kim Jong-un that he could not afford to say yes to, because even though he's called a, quote, dictator, and he undoubtedly has primary influence in North Korea, he's not running the country by himself. There's an establishment and undoubtedly something of a collective leadership that had a preordained agreement about what was acceptable, what the terms of the deal were. If suddenly he was confronted with a new set of terms that he couldn't say yes to, and there was no sanctions relief coming unless he said yes to this thing that he wasn't prepared to say yes to, you can see right then and there why he would have to say, I can't do that.
Close all the facilities and then the ballistic issue. That sounds a lot like the Pompeo and Bolton demands from Singapore.
Well, yeah, I would make a little distinction between Pompeo and Bolton. Okay. Bolton is a true, I mean, we don't know about Pompeo. That's the only reason I would make a distinction.
Okay.
Pompeo has been Trump's point man going forward, negotiating directly with Kim Jong-chul, a general, a confidant of Kim Jong-un. He seemed to have wanted to make the thing happen. Bolton is a saboteur.
Right.
Bolton was the one who said, hey, our model for North Korea's denuclearization is Libya.
It's Libya, right.
Which could only mean like, okay, we're going to execute, lynch the head of state in the streets and then celebrate it. Or at least that's how it would be perceived by the North Koreans. But here again, you know, you're on to something, Wilmer, because if the North Koreans feel, look, if we give up everything with no immediate reciprocal sort of lifting of economic sanctions, if we make ourselves more vulnerable and weak, as, say, Gaddafi did mm-hmm. when he pledged to get rid of nuclear weapons, we're not going down that road. And that raises in my mind the question, were there people in Trump's circle who deliberately upped the ante at the end, knowing that the North Koreans couldn't do it? Or on the other hand, there's another possible theory, which is that U.S. intelligence provided this new information about other facilities beyond Yongbyon nuclear facility, and that Trump and Pompeo knew about it, but they could not raise the issue with the North Koreans absent the personal presence of Kim Jong-un, because what other authority outside of him could cope with that new intelligence from the United States and thus the new higher demand on the North Korean delegation from the United States? So we don't know exactly what happened. We're not the fly on the wall. But I have to tell you, I think it's disappointing. Just think about sanctions and what they are. Let's look at big picture for our audience. Sanctions are, you deliberately deprive people of energy, of the ability to heat their homes, of having food, of having medicine when they and their children are sick. You try to bring an economy to its knees. It's an insidious form of warfare. The U.S. can say, well, North Korea built 60 nuclear bombs. Well, guess what? North Korea actually didn't do that illegally because North Korea withdrew from the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty in 2002, which is the right of any country. Because when George W. Bush said, you're part of the axis of evil, and The other two spokes of the axis are Iraq and Iran, and Bush was preparing to invade Iraq. The North Koreans said, well, no, we're not going to be like Saddam. We're not going to be disarmed. We're going to get nuclear weapons. And they started building nuclear weapons after they withdrew from the NPT. That's not illegal. What made it illegal was the UN Security Council being bullied by the United States, which itself is in non-compliance with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And it is because all the nuclear powers have an affirmative obligation to get rid of their nuclear weapons. And the U.S. is not doing that. It's modernizing its nuclear weapons. So here's the United States using sanctions to punish a whole people because their government legally created 60 nuclear bombs while the U.S. itself is in non-compliance. So outside of the punditry around this issue, I want people to think about it big picture. Why are the North Koreans being ground down and starved? Because they don't want to make their country completely vulnerable to an Iraq or Libya-style attack. I mean, you know, let's think about it that way.
Sticking with the big picture analysis, is the discussion of sanctions, to a certain degree, putting the cart before the horse if you don't end the war first?
Exactly. What the U.S. government is basically saying to the North Koreans is, we're not going to sign a declaration of peace. We're not going to sign a peace treaty, which means technically we are at war. But now we want you to disarm yourself, to get rid of your nuclear weapons while we possess thousands of nuclear weapons. And we have them on Trident submarines, on B-52 bombers, B-1 bombers, B-2 bombers, bombers that are used to simulate your annihilation. We have them on land-based missiles. We've surrounded you, but now you must disarm in order to get the reward of having economic sanctions lifted. I mean, just like think of it in that way, and that helps you understand the predicament that the North Koreans have. You don't have to like North Korea. You don't have to.
You know what, though, Brian? Now, you know a lot more about this than I do, but I would not describe it as this is the predicament that the North Koreans find themselves in. I would say this is the reality that Kim Jong-un clearly understands. America eats its young. America murders its allies, a la Gaddafi, a la Saddam Hussein. And, you know, you play with the United States at your own risk. And the final point on that is nuclear weapons are the only thing that has brought the United States to the table. So I would say Kim Jong-un, looking at the cards in his hand, he's saying, you want me to show my hand, you want me to throw my cards in when these are the only things that brought you to the table, and I know clearly what you do once your friends go along with your program.
That's true, and that's why the U.S. is negotiating with the North Koreans. But again, to go back to the predicament of North Korea, You can only really go forward in your country with its economy by integrating into the world economy.
Right.
You can't, because you don't have certain things. You might not have enough oil. You might not have enough gasoline. You might not have enough spare parts. Even a self-reliant economy is dependent on the world economy. So if the United States is the gatekeeper to entrance into the world economy, and they can keep you out, and then you build nuclear weapons as a way to kind of bust through the gate, say, come on, see, we'll give up our nuclear weapons, right, to be able to play in the same economic playing field. And then you have the U.S. government saying, but you're now monsters. You're monsters, and you're threatening us, and you're threatening the world. You're nuclear monsters, and we're going to make you a pariah. And then they say, okay, now you must give up everything that you have that brought you to the negotiating table, and we're not going to back down because actually the status quo isn't that painful for us. It's painful for you. Even with nuclear weapons as a bargaining chip, they don't overcome the fundamental inequality between the United States in a still emerging country, emerging from the legacy of colonialism and underdevelopment. That's the predicament of North Korea. And that, in fact, is the predicament of any government in a country, an emerging country that seeks to be independent of the United States. And that's the problem.
Final two questions, real quick answers. And I thank you so much, Brian Becker, for giving me your time and your analysis today. When all the dust settles, it looks like Vietnam is actually the real winner in terms of this summit. Your thoughts?
Well, Vietnam is a winner because Vietnam is honored to be the host of such an important gathering. But I think what Vietnam wanted was to be the host of something historic.
Sure.
And this was not historic.
But in terms of their economy and them being on display, in terms of world display, and now a whole lot of people will, wow, if Kim and Trump can go to Vietnam, then maybe we should think about going to Vietnam for vacation.
Oh, yeah. Well, that from that point of view, you're absolutely right. I mean, it takes the fear factor out for a lot of people who might not know Vietnam. They know it as a place where there was a guerrilla war,
exactly.
You know, 45 years ago. But, you know, this is a thriving country. It's 95 million people. It's bigger than the UK, bigger than Germany, bigger than France. It's got a younger population. It's dynamic.
What a lot of people don't realize is that I want to say at least up to maybe 3 years ago, it was considered the fastest growing economy in the world.
Yeah. I mean, it's really a remarkable transformation. And again, you know, the only reason that the United States treats Vietnam as an equal is that the United States was defeated by Vietnam on the battlefield. That's kind of the United States was partly defeated by the Koreans, and the U.S. in a way never forgave North Korea for that. But in the case of Vietnam, it's not simply because the U.S. was defeated, but the Vietnamese have earned their place at a table, and they paid a very, very heavy price for it.
Final question for you. Amidst all of this international activity and the diplomacy, the Cohen hearings yesterday took precedent, dominated the news cycle here. How did that play there?
Yeah, Michael Cohen is like trying to think of the smallest little insect that you are aware of. And that's how important Michael Cohen is to the people in Vietnam or the people in Asia. I mean, I can't describe this as anything other than a setup and a fraud. The fact that the Michael Cohen hearings dominated the U.S. news at the moment that there was possibly a historic breakthrough for peace on the Korean Peninsula. That shows the, you know, sort of the disgusting, bizarre and disgusting character of the U.S. corporate-owned media. But, you know, I talk to people back in the States. They say, oh, the summit's not even on the news here, basically. It's Michael Cohen, Michael Cohen, Michael Cohen. And the fact of the matter is Michael Cohen said nothing. Michael Cohen offered nothing. Michael Cohen said he had no proof of collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. He had no evidence of anything. This was purely designed as a way to distract attention from what might have been a huge diplomatic breakthrough, not for Donald Trump, even though it would have been perceived to be such, but for peace and for people in the Korean Peninsula who have suffered a great deal. To my mind, that's the most callous form of cynicism on display again, as it is every day with the U.S. corporate-owned media.
Brian Becker, co-host of Loud and Clear, joining us from Hanoi. Brian, appreciate your time. Thank you so much for that fantastic analysis and look forward to seeing you back here. Safe travels.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right, folks, you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Mandelblit announces intent to indict Benjamin Netanyahu for bribery. Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit announced today his intent to indict Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for bribery in a blockbuster decision that could decisively impact the April 9th election. Mandelblit said that Netanyahu will be indicted for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust in three cases. What does this mean for the upcoming elections in Israel and the politics of the region going forward? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, focusing on Middle East, U.S., wars, and U.N. issues. She is also a fellow of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam, Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Great to be with you, Wilmer.
So first, did I pronounce his name properly?
Close enough.
Okay, thank you very much. So Netanyahu faces three cases. Explain to us what he's facing. And he has been under this scrutiny for quite a while. Why has it taken this long to get this far?
Well, some of it has to do with the nature of the legal system in Israel, which is a little bit different here in terms of how indictments actually happen. There hasn't been an indictment yet. What we heard was from the Attorney General that he believes there should be an indictment. And in the Israeli system, he gets to choose. So when he says there should be an indictment, that's what is likely to happen. Now, there have been, what we've been hearing about for several years now, is a series of police reports that have indicated that their investigations show that there should be an indictment. But the police don't get to bring those indictments. It's up to the Attorney General, who today has said that in those three cases, they're known throughout the country as case 1000, case 2000, and case 4000, case 3000 apparently didn't make the cut, that they should result in indictments of the sitting prime minister. And they have to do with various things having to do with bribery. In case 1000, it had to do with things like fancy cigars, pink champagne, even tickets to see Mariah Carey at some concert. All of these things illegally received by primarily the prime minister and his wife. I think his sons were involved in a bit of it. And in exchange, they provided various kinds of political favors to various wealthy millionaires and billionaires in Israel. The total that they're accused of receiving was something close to $300,000.
They really don't do it well in Israel, because in the United States, $300,000 won't get you much.
Well, you know, we're talking about jewelry, Cuban cigars. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not talking about houses and things here.
Okay,
but
right.
This is serious. This is serious stuff. $300,000 is not chump change.
No, you're right.
When you're the prime minister of a government. Now, given our government, we might say that is chump change. But we're not going there right now.
Right.
Now, in the second case, it had to do with one of our favorite people to talk about, Sheldon Adelson, who is a U.S. citizen, a casino magnat and billionaire, one of the most important financial supporters of Donald Trump, and also a huge financial supporter of Benjamin Netanyahu. So this case involves a kind of quid pro quo with a newspaper that was starting to be quite critical of Netanyahu. And the deal was Netanyahu was going to push Sheldon Adelson to cut back on the numbers produced of his personal newspaper. It's a paper, a free newspaper in Israel called Israel Hayom, that has been nothing but glorifying Netanyahu since it began. Adelson produces it, publishes it, and distributes it for free. So the deal was that he got Adelson to cut back on the number of his free newspapers in return for the other newspaper agreeing to do more favorable coverage. So that one was kind of a breach of trust, bribery kind of issue. Then the fourth one had to do with potential fraud. It had to do with regulatory issues. There were favors to Bezeq, which is the big Israeli telephone and telecommunications company. And in return for that, they would get guarantees of better coverage on one of the very popular news sites that happens to be owned by that company. So it was all of these efforts to get either money or better coverage of what Netanyahu was doing. That was the goal here, to make sure he gets reelected. The elections are set for April, and the polls were indicating that for the first time in a while, he actually might have a possible serious competition. He's been in office now for 13 years, 10 years and then a break, and before that, three earlier years. But there's a whole generation in Israel that have basically known no one else as as prime minister. And one of the things that has made that possible is that his absolute top goal is to stay in power. Now, to do that, he has to keep these right-wing parties in power, getting votes. And, you know, it's one of these things, Wilmer, that people have a really hard time. I have a hard time, and I've known this for years, but I have a hard time believing it. But Netanyahu has been, for the last, like, 2 years at least, the furthest left wing of his cabinet. Now, it seems crazy to say that, because Netanyahu is this right-wing ideologue. His policies have been incredibly right-wing. But the political discourse in Israel has moved so far to the right that his cabinet has made up essentially of the right wing, his party, the Likud party, the right wing party, the far right, the extreme right, and what I would carefully call the fascist right.
Mm.
That combination has put him at the left now. And it's so skewed that what we're now hearing about, there's two different new developments that are both leading to the possibility that Netanyahu might face a real challenge. One has to do with the creation of a new party. It's known as the Blue and White Party.
Benny Gantz.
That's Benny Gantz.
Okay.
Is one of the two leaders of that party, and it's being talked about in the Israeli press, and sometimes here, because people here seem to pick it up as it's the left mm-hmm. challenging mm-hmm. Netanyahu for the first time in years. Well, it is the first serious challenge in years, but this is not anything close to the left. This is a very right-wing, I would say probably center-right, new party. It's to the left of Netanyahu, but that's an incredibly low bar, right? So in that context, we're seeing this new party led by this guy, Benny Gantz, who's a general. The top four people in the new party, three of them are former generals. Benny Gantz is the former chief of staff of the Israeli military, and his campaign video, shocking, absolutely, you know, one of these things that, given Israeli politics, shouldn't be surprising, but is shocking, is an airborne video festival, if you will, of the massive destruction of the Gaza Strip following the Israeli assault of the summer of 2014.
Mm.
Benny Gantz was the commander mm-hmm. of that assault
mm-hmm.
that led to the killing of over 2,200 people in Gaza, the vast majority of them civilians, including many children. It's been a horrific scenario in Gaza. And this campaign video trumpets that as a great victory. It talks about how many so-called terrorists Benny Gantz has killed and how the destruction of Gaza was bombing them back to the Stone Age. It's the most abusive kind of cruelty that one could imagine. And that's what Benny Gantz and his coalition partner, Yair Lapid, are running on. They may get some of those right-wing voters that up until now have gone with Netanyahu, but they've also made a commitment that they would strengthen the settlement blocks, that they would never leave the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. Gantz refused to endorse a two-state solution at all. Similar to Netanyahu. He said at one point that the Jordan Valley would be our border. The Jordan Valley is in the middle of the West Bank,
mm-hmm.
you know, so
mm-hmm.
he's already talking about taking more land. So it's a very dangerous development, but it could lead to a slight change in the international arena, only because it could lead to a situation where Netanyahu's personal ties, particularly to Donald Trump and Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, that little bromance has been a key part of building the anti-Iran alliance that's underway between Israel and Saudi Arabia. That could shift around a bit without Netanyahu and that history to rely on. So that's part of where there could be a bit of change.
Well, wait a minute. When you say shift around a bit, what do you mean? And shift in what direction?
Well, it's hard to know. I don't anticipate that if this new blue and white party won the election, it would be with a small number of votes. There's no mm-hmm. way they're going to win outright. But if they were given the first chance to put together a coalition government, they would suddenly be led by somebody, Benny Gantz, who is not well known in Washington, who is not the kind of smooth U.S.-looking Netanyahu. Netanyahu, of course, grew up in the U.S. for mm-hmm. a good part of his life. He mm-hmm. went to school at MIT. His English is better than mine. He speaks like an American. He doesn't talk like an Israeli. That's not the case for Benny Gantz. Benny Gantz speaks accented English. He doesn't have the U.S. style mm-hmm. that Netanyahu has cultivated over the years. And crucially, even more important than that, he doesn't have the contacts. He doesn't have the personal phone numbers of everybody in the White House and half of Congress the way Netanyahu does. So he would not be in the same position in terms of the relationship with the United States. That doesn't mean he would actually engage in any significant political change inside Israel. As far as we can tell, his policies will be very much the same. You know, one of the ironies is all of this news today is coming out at the same time that the United Nations has just issued the report of the special commission that was asked to investigate the human rights situation in Gaza mm-hmm. involving the Great March of Return protests. And in that report, which among other things indicates that over 6,000 people were shot, 940 children were shot, 39 journalists were shot, two of them killed, 122 people had their legs amputated, 20 of them children, and that in all but two of those cases, the use of live ammunition was unlawful. That report has just been released, and it was Benny Gantz who was the commander of those actions. Whether that could lead to an indictment by the International Criminal Court, for example, against Benny Gantz, the new potential Israeli prime minister, it's much too soon to tell, but it raises that, certainly it should raise that as a possibility.
And just real quick, just to that point,
sure.
With your understanding of Israeli politics, what impact would that have on the dialogue in Israel? Would with his using this aerial footage of the atrocities as a campaign video, sounds to me like that would be appealing to his base, similar to what Donald Trump is doing with build the wall, build the wall.
It's very similar. In fact, his slogan that he has claimed is Israel first.
When are we
very
got
much
that from?
Like the right-wing leader in Italy who is using the term Italy first. Mm-hmm. It seems to be a thing for the global right wing. So, yeah, I don't anticipate that any of this is going to lead to concern or lack of support for him. Quite the contrary.
Got it.
On the other side, on the right-wing side, even further to the right, the other strategy that Netanyahu is looking at here to shore up his own possibilities of winning the election. His whole goal, remember, is he has to keep these right-wing parties getting mm-hmm. as much support as possible. He started worrying that the far right might be getting fewer votes than it has in the past. So one of the things that just happened in Israel was the reacceptance, if you will, of a small fringe party called Jewish Power that was linked to the now dead Meir Kahane, who was an American Jew, a rabbi, created and led the Jewish Defense League, in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
A splinter group from that group were the ones who shot into my house in L.A. back in 1982. These guys were so extreme that they had been kept out of the parliamentary process in Israel for the last, I think it's been about 15 years. They have just been welcomed to come back into electoral legitimacy. They've been made kosher, in the words of one of the Israeli newspapers. And what happened is they have now linked with one of the other right-wing parties, a small, extreme right-wing party called Jewish Home. So Jewish Home and Jewish Power are now a unified party. If that party gets up to 5 members in the Knesset, if they win that many votes, the Jewish Power group, the Kahanist extremist group, which calls for forcible transfer of Palestinians out of Israel and out of the West Bank, calls for the annexation of West Bank territory, calls for a seizure of the Temple Mount in occupied East Jerusalem and the creation of what they like to call the Third Temple. It's an incredible extremist outfit. They would have the potential to have at least two people in among those five seats if the unified party won, and they have been promised two positions in the cabinet under Netanyahu.
Okay.
So he is prepared to link with what the Jewish Forward, the main Jewish weekly newspaper in the United States, what they called the equivalent of one of the U.S. parties inviting the Ku Klux Klan to join their ranks.
I got to stop you there. Phyllis Bennis from the Institute of Policy Studies. As always, Phyllis, you are so gracious when I call. I truly, truly appreciate it. Thank you for your analysis. Thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
I look forward to it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Phyllis. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Senator Cory Booker's announcement on February 1st that he is entering the 2020 presidential race brings the number of African-American Democrats seeking their party's nomination to two, making the crowded primary field the most diverse in history, according to the New York Times. But while the New York Times, cable news, and other liberal pundits exult in the White House bids of Booker and California's junior Senator Kamala Harris, African-Americans, ironically enough, have not uniformly mustered nearly as much enthusiasm for either candidate. So what does this mean for the 2020 election and the dialogue going forward? Well, for this, we turn to my next guest. He is a former Washington Post bureau chief and award-winning foreign correspondent on two continents, John Jeter. John, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Always a pleasure, Doctor. Thank you for having me.
So what I just read was the opening to your piece, Flat Broke, Black Voters Want More Than Just Another Black President. What is it that motivated you to write this piece?
Well, I think what really motivated me was a sort of going over the numbers of the alleged recovery for blacks after the Great Recession and finding that, you know, we're really in worse shape in terms of our loss, our material losses. We're in worse shape now than we've been since the Freedmen's Bank failed in 1874. We're in a lot of trouble. I think we're really, black people that is, black Americans, are really facing the gravest existential crisis since the emancipation.
When people hear you say that African Americans are in a worse position now than when the Freedmen's Bank failed in the 1800s, a lot of folks would say, now, wait a minute, we're driving cars, we own homes, our kids are going to college, we're doctors, we're lawyers, we're dentists. So explain how you get to that statement.
Well, I'll tell you, I came across a stunning statistic in a new book. I think it's called, I can't remember the name of it, but it's by a Tanzanian academic who lives in the U.S., and it's about black banks. And she came up with a statistic. She found that when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed in 1863, January 1st, 1863, the share of all national wealth in the United States controlled by blacks was 0.5%. Now, after we've had a black president and the civil rights movement and all of these things, blacks, 42 million people, control all of 1% of national wealth. That could only happen by design. That's not an accident. And so I think what we're seeing is the culmination of a political economy that is at its heart a racial kleptocracy. I don't think there's any other way you can explain 1% for 42 million very hardworking people. And so that's why I say I think we're facing an existential crisis when you combine our material losses with our the incarceration crisis, with the healthcare crisis and sort of all the other sort of crises that are attendant to a post-industrializing state.
So do you see any impact that this could have on either turnout, on policy for the Democratic Party, since the African-American community has been such a staunch supporter of the party since the late 1950s? How do you see this playing out, or is this a warning sign for Democrats?
Well, I think it has very real ramifications for both parties, but specifically for the Democrats. I'll go on record and say this right now. If the Democrats don't nominate, if they don't nominate their most progressive candidate, they will not get Black voter turnout. If they don't get Black voter turnout, they won't win. It's just that simple. That's why Hillary lost. She saw a decline in Black voter turnout. If you were to project that she would have gotten the same turnout as Obama or more, she would have won. She'd be in the White House right now. So this is a very clear indication of what's going to happen. Either the Democrats are going to embrace their progressive wing, which, of course, Blacks have always been their most progressive constituency, and they're going to either embrace that progressive wing and win the White House in 2020, which means they'll probably have to turn to some extent on their donors on Wall Street, or they're going to do like they did in 2016, marginalize their progressive wing, and they're going to lose. So I think it has very real ramifications.
And it's interesting because the Hillary supporters will blame Bernie Sanders. They'll blame anybody they can blame except for Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton had zero spend in African-American media. She turned to Barack Obama at the end of her campaign, seemingly out of desperation, figuring that he would generate the turnout, not understanding that Black voter turnout in his second term was down. And you make this interesting point in your piece. You write that yawning racial wealth gap certainly did not begin on Obama's watch, but his administration's handling of the 2008 financial meltdown essentially erased all of the savings and investments accrued to a generation of African Americans. So thinking that an African American president was going to be the be all and end all for the African American community was a fallacy from the start.
I think, if you'll forgive the expression, I think the Democrats have shot their wad on two counts. One, they, in this crisis, in this really unprecedented crisis, they turned to a Black president, Black presidential nominee, thinking that he could basically hold back this knavish mob at the gate. Now, think about what I wrote. What happened in the subprime crisis was the heist of the century, right? If that had been, and that targeted, as we know from court documents, targeted quote unquote mud people with quote unquote ghetto loans, right? The one in every 624 homes in Prince George's County, the most affluent, majority Black community in the United States, one in every 624 homes is in foreclosure right now. Across the Potomac in Fairfax County, Virginia, where two in every three people are white, is one in every 5,000 homes or something like that. This was a racial crime. It was a white collar crime that focused on Black people. And that's why we're seeing this crisis to the extent that we're seeing in the Black community. What the Democrats did, what Wall Street did, was they did two things which they can't do again. One is they ran a Black president thinking that would appease Black people. And they were right. Unfortunately, they were right. It did that time. I don't think it's going to work again. You're seeing that now with people being very publicly critical of Kamala Harris for the role that she played as a prosecutor both in San Francisco and the state of California, and with Cory Booker, who people are just not high on at all for many reasons, including his role in really sort of destroying public education and undermining the teachers union in Newark, New Jersey. So they played that hand. I don't think they can play that hand again. I don't think Black people, we really are, despite the fact that we went for the okey-doke the first time, we really are the most sophisticated voting bloc in this country historically. So I don't think we'll go for that again. And the second is they, with this quantitative easing where they reinflated the bubble, they made money so cheap that they reinflated the bubble. Well, the problem is you can only do that once for a short period of time. There's another great recession, and there almost inevitably will be very soon, in the next year or two, probably, they're not going to have that tool available to them. You can't continue to make money so cheap. At a certain point, inflation kicks in and the money becomes worthless. So I think, you know, we're really seeing a very real crisis. One, unfortunately, that the media does not understand and therefore does not report on.
The book you were talking about early in the interview, I think, was The Color of Money.
Yes.
Okay. By Mesra Batadaran.
I don't want to butcher her name, but I think that's how it's pronounced.
Let me do it. Let me butcher her name. Yeah. But real quick. So how does this translate into take it out of a racial context and put it in a class context? When we look at the impact of the working poor in this country, when we look at the impact of the working class in this country, because that to me is how, by putting it in the larger class context, I would think that's how you get through to a Nancy Pelosi. That's how you would get through to a Chuck Schumer, and understanding that there is a huge working class element in of your base that you need to appeal to.
Yeah, I think the biggest mistake that we can make, both in terms of Black people and in terms of working class people, is to overestimate their intelligence. I don't think the Chuck Schumers and the Nancy Pelosi's are that smart.
I agree.
I don't think they understand, largely because of the failure of the media. We're not connected to one another, and they don't understand. I mean, the average politician inside the Beltway simply doesn't understand just how poorly working class people, but especially Black working class people, are living these days.
That's why I need you as John Jeter to explain it to them. That's what I'm asking you to do. John, we need you to explain it to them.
Well, I'm doing the best that I can, but I think the problem is that they don't know what they don't know.
Right.
And so it's very hard to, and really when you're talking about both the media, which is wider than it's ever been, right? The media today is wider, I think, as a percentage of the media that's available to us. It's wider now than it was in like 1895 or something like that, percentage-wise. And at the same time, our politics has been so purged of dissenting voices that, you know, I think what's going to happen, this is what I believe is going to happen. I don't know, obviously. I think this election is going to be a real opportunity for Black people to put a Black agenda on the table. I think you see with Elizabeth Warren, with Bernie Sanders, with Kamala Harris, although I don't think she's going to be successful, even with this writer, Marianne Williamson, who's running for the Democratic nomination. I think we're seeing Democrats understand that Hillary lost not because of Kremlin, not because of Putin in the Kremlin, but because of, to use Obama's favorite pejorative stereotype, of Black people. She lost because of Pookie in Cleveland, right? Because mm-hmm. of Pookie in Cleveland didn't come out to vote. And if you're going to win in 2020 against Trump, you're going to have to get Black, you have to gin up Black voter turnout.
So to that point, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I only got a couple minutes left and I want to be sure I get this out. I was just having this conversation coming into the studio today with a very dear friend of mine. And my question was, so where is the Congressional Black Caucus on this point? And he and I were talking on the international front in terms of either implicitly or explicitly backing the play in Venezuela, ignoring what's happening in Haiti, and not understanding that we have to internationalize our conversations, that we can't just sit huddled in our homes and ignore the rest of the world. And what I have found is that the Congressional Black Caucus is conspicuously silent on these issues.
I would say it's even wider than that. I think that we're also going to see these contradictions between the Black working class and this Black black political elite really coming to the forefront over the next couple of years. You know, when you hear the media talk about how Bernie has a problem with black voters, he doesn't have a problem with black voters. He has a problem with Hillary's support.
There you go.
Within the black community. That's her problem. So I think you're going to see these contradictions come to bear. I would say this too, and I don't know how we do this. I'm not a tactician, but I do think that the black movements that we saw in the 60s and 70s, they won't be exactly like that. But we need to reinvent those movements, which were driven from the bottom, not the top. We can't have the Kamala Harris's and the Barack Obama's us telling black people how we resist. We can't have that. So we're going to somehow figure out a way to reinvent these movements to drive the conversation at the top. Because one way or another, they're going to have to respond to us. If they don't, this dystopian reality that we're all living is going to implode. This is mathematical, right? At a certain point, people owe so much money, the economy just collapses on itself. We're fast reaching that point. And it's almost like a Ponzi scheme, but the people on the bottom, the last ones in, always are black people. And you can't address, you can't sustain that system. You have to address the fact, yes, it's a class-based system, but the way that the United States has always divided the working class is through the use of racism.
Absolutely
right.
And to
the point where now, I think it's going to be very difficult. I think it's going to be very difficult to disabuse the white supremacists out there, of whom there are millions, tens of millions, to disabuse them of this notion that they are superior, right? That this is a Ponzi scheme and their racism is a predicate for this Ponzi scheme. So that's just where I am. I don't know where this is going to end up, but I think we're at a very precarious point.
I got to stop you there. Flat broke. Black voters want more than just another black president. You can find it at truthout.org. Truthout.org. My guest, John Jeter, is the author. And as always, John, thank you so much for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you, Doctor.
My man. Folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I want to thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.